The Australian Years, 1891 to 1900, Volume 4, Chapter 27. 1897, Sunnyside and Beyond 1897. While the physical development of the Avondale School drew heavily on Ellen White's time and strength through much of the year 1897, she was also involved in the home activities, in an outreach and coming to the aid of needy families in the community, and, of course, deeply engrossed in discharging her responsibilities as the messenger of the Lord. There was her writing for publication, and she was producing an almost constant stream of letters, many bearing messages of counsel or reproof. As noted earlier, W. C. White was in the United States on a tour of activity that, as it worked out, kept him from home until late October. We have noted that as the year 1897 opened, his wife, May, with the four children, Ella, Mabel, and the 8-month-old twins, had just moved from the convent where they had lived for some months, to Sunnyside, and were occupying the little house at the rear, the two-room washhouse and woodshed where the twins were born. It was not large enough. Ellen White's proposal to build on a kitchen and veranda turned out unfeasible, and several alternatives were considered. It was hoped that W. C. White could sell his Battle Creek home and build a cottage across the road from Sunnyside. Grandma and the twins. Grandma White doted a bit over the twins. "They both know me," she wrote to their father in mid-January, "and laugh and crow as soon as I come in sight. I take one, and the other will work his arms and make every maneuver to have me take him, too. But one, you know, is an armful. It is a treat to me to see and tend the little ones whenever I can." Letter 169, 1897. In mid-March she wrote to Willie, "Both are very spry at creeping, something you, their father, never did do." Letter 189, 1897. And 3 months later she reported that they were trotting around now. Letter 138, 1897. They were delighted when grandmother would take them for a ride in her carriage. She wrote of this to Edson on July 4 midwinter for Australia. "Willie's family are all well. The boys are healthy, rosy-cheeked, rollicking little fellows. When Sarah and I go to Morisset, 4 miles and a half, or to Corinbon, 1 mile and a half, or to Dora Creek, 3 miles, we manage to tuck in the children and give May a little resting spell. Having to manage the two, she cannot do much else. The lads have learned when the horse comes to the piazza, they will both run to Grandma, their two pairs of little arms stretched out, saying, 'Gigi, Gigi.' This is about all the words they speak. They are in such ecstasies over getting a chance to ride that I have not the heart to say, 'No.' So they bundle in with their little red coats and white plush caps. We are all caught in the mistake of not distinguishing them one from the other. They have been good-natured and not troublesome, but now they are so lively we will have to watch them. They have lived very much in the open air, and can scarcely be content indoors. Their great delight is in being on the ground. Willie has been having a one-story cottage built. We have arranged that the piazzas shall be 8 feet wide and on two sides of the house. The railing is made so that there is not a possibility of their getting out or falling over, and there is a gate that will have a spring catch which will keep them corralled, so the young white colts will not be straying out in the woods like lost sheep." Letter 164, 1897. The building of Willie's house. The building of the cottage for Willie's family was, of course, being done in his absence. Ellen White and Sarah McKenterfer supervised the work. To Willie she wrote on June 10th, "We have gone ahead to build your house, and if anyone wants to grumble, you will be out of it altogether. Those who are now on the ground will take the blame. But I meant that everything should be done that could be done, in a plain, wholesome way, for your family. The house may look unnecessarily large, but I have looked it over and over, and could not bring my mind to diminish 1 foot in any direction. I have never been required before to do so much thinking and planning in so many lines, especially in reference to this house. I want your house to be a comfortable home, and there is not a thing I would detach from the building." Letter 138, 1897. Writing to Edson and Emma of some of the problems she was confronted with, she mentioned the expense of building in Australia. "It costs just about double to build a house here, and takes 3 times as long as to build a house in America. Before the weather boards can be nailed on the house, everyone has to be bored with a gimlet to put the nails through the wood. It is so hard. The wrought iron nails will double up if this is not done. So you see everything takes longer and lumber is more expensive. Then here our boards for floor come from Oregon, America. All the lumber here will shrink very much. The buildings which should not cost in America over £100 cannot be built here for less than £200. This makes all meeting houses and all dwelling houses cost much more than in America." Letter 164, 1897. The missionary outreach. "We have located here on missionary soil," wrote Ellen White on June 9th, "and we design to teach the people all round us how to cultivate the land. They are all poor because they have left their land uncultivated. We are experimenting, and showing them what can be done in fruit raising and gardening. Letter 33, 1897. They tried also to set a good example in animal husbandry. Their animals were well fed and well cared for. The white cow that recently had given birth to a heifer calf, which they were raising, was giving 22 quarts of milk a day, and the nearly dry red cow, 4 quarts. Both Ellen White's large family of workers and guests, and W.C. White's family, were supplied abundantly with milk. Letter 141, 1897. In the economically depressed times, Ellen White continued to help needy families. Of this she wrote on February 10, "We have a supply of poor families that must be kindly cared for and helped to help themselves. We have these poor as a legacy from God to us. Inasmuch as ye do this to one of the least of these, my brethren, ye do it unto me. Then we will work on, doing our level best to alleviate the care of the poor, helping them when we can and strengthening them all we can in correct methods." Letter 187, 1897. Her home and office helpers also participated. She gave a report of this on June 9. "Last evening we had a Dorcas Society in our home, and my workers who help in the preparation of my articles and for the papers, and do the cooking and sewing, 5 of them, sat up until midnight, cutting out clothing. They made 3 pairs of pants for the children of one family. 2 sewing machines were running until midnight. I think there was never a happier set of workers than were these girls last evening." Letter 113, 1897. The literary work, the day-by-day entries in Ellen White's diary tell of the relentless demands of her literary work. As the reader has often noted, this usually began in the early hours of the day. In one entry she explains, "The morning hours, from 3 a.m. until 7 a.m., are my best hours to write, for that I am not broken in upon and obliged to give my time to advise with my brethren and counsel with them." Manuscript 175, 1897. But beyond the writing, she needed to give diligent attention to the proofreading of materials copied. "I have been awakened at 3:30 a.m. I see I have several articles put under my door to read this morning, to see if all is correct. Ibid." In a letter to G.E.A. Irwin, newly elected president of the General Conference, she disclosed in her appeal for more literary help something of the way she worked. "I have a very large amount of matter which I desire to have come before the people, but I have no one to consider these matters with me. If I could have Sister Peck and Willie, I could get off many important things much more perfectly. I ought to have someone to whom I can read every article before sending it to the mail." This always helps the writer, for the helper often discerns more clearly what is wanted, and the slight changes that should be made. "It is an important matter to keep in its simplicity all that matter that I write. I am sure my 2 editors endeavor to preserve my words, not supplying their own in place of them." Letter 76, 1897. Shortly before this, the General Conference had officially released W.C. White from administrative duties in Australia so that he might give more of his time to his mother's literary work, but he was still in America performing errands for the Australasian Union Conference. A few months later, Sarah Peck was released from teaching in South Africa to join Ellen White's staff. Sarah McIntyre Fur Community Nurse. It was not too long after Sarah McIntyre Fur, a graduate nurse from Battle Creek, rejoined Ellen White's staff until she was involved in caring for the sick and injured in the community for some miles around. The nearest physician was 20 miles distant, and charged £5 to make a visit. On Friday, July 23, a young man named Clautson came running to the house all the way from Dora Creek to report that a young man there was very sick with inflammation of the lungs and would die unless he had help, wrote Ellen White. "The family is large and they are not poor, but most bitterly opposed to Seventh-day Adventists. The father of this large family will not allow one of our faith to step foot on or across his premises. We thought this might be an opportunity to break down this prejudice." Sarah and May White went as soon as they could gather up articles to take with them to help the sick man. They found him with his eyes glazed. He was unconscious. The room was full of his parents and brothers and sisters. There were no windows open, not a crack of air for ventilating the room. Sarah took charge at once, told them that they were killing him, that the lungs must have food good, pure air. All must leave the room but those required to wait on him. She examined the house and told them he must be moved into the sitting room. First, she directed that his bowels, which were burning hot, be relieved by an enema, administered by 2 brethren who were present. Then a cot was brought in, and Sarah made it up. Then, all unconscious of everything, he was moved by 4 men onto the cot, and plenty of air was given him. He fell asleep for the first time since Monday. After remaining until the afternoon was nearly gone, Sarah and May returned. Manuscript 174, 1897. But the good work started by Sarah was cut short. A physician who had been sent for before Sarah was called, and who had waited on the young man earlier in the week, came belatedly on Friday evening. He was surprised to find the young man had made a change for the better and was rational. When told what treatment the patient had received, the doctor said it could not be bettered, declared the young man free from fever, and left word to give him a drop or two of liquor if he had sinking spells. When William Clouston came in a bit later, he found a blazing fire in the room and the windows all closed. He put the fire out, threw the wood out of doors, opened the windows, and bathed the patient's face and head. "You are a good fellow, Billy Clouston," the patient said. "You know what to do for a fellow. I feel better. Ibid." The father and brothers were drinking rum when Clouston left, and proposed giving some to the sick man. "Don't give him a drop. If you do, it will kill him," Clouston admonished. They said they would not give him any. His brothers told Clouston that he was the only member of the family who would not drink, he would never touch it. But after Clouston left, they thought he was weakening and gave him liquor. When Clouston called in the morning, he found the young man was dead. "You gave him liquor," he charged. The family admitted they had, and in doing so were responsible for the death of the son. Numerous other cases, but other cases had a much happier ending. Many times it was children who were involved in accidents of one kind or another. Sometimes the patient would be brought to Ellen White's or W.C. White's home and nursed back to health. A few excerpts from her diary through the early part of September, 1897, yield a picture of this work of community ministry. "Wednesday, September 1st, while I was reading the mail, a woman from Dora Creek came up with her baby for instruction on what to do for the child. Thursday, September 2nd, we went to see the child that was brought to our house yesterday that was sick. Sarah prescribed for her, and the mother followed the prescription. We learned today the child was relieved. The father of the first child that had appealed for help asked me if we did not receive pay for our trouble. We told him no, we did not do the work for pay, only to relieve suffering humanity as Christ did when he was in our world. They seemed very thankful. As soon as this case was off our hands and we were nearly home, we learned a messenger had come for Sarah to see if she could come to see a suffering boy who had stepped in a hole where there was a broken bottle, and had cut his foot fearfully. She went in the house for flannel fomentation cloths, Vaseline, and several necessary articles with which to work, turned her horse, and was away again. She found a very aggravated case. It had been hurt 2 weeks, was fearfully cut, and proud flesh was revealed. Friday, September 3rd, Sarah visited the afflicted sick boy whose foot and ankle were so badly mangled. She found the poor suffering one weary and distressed. He was crying, "Oh, she does not come, she will not come today. Oh, I want her to come. Oh, what will I do?" She opened the door, and he was pleased. She remained with him until noon, ministering to that suffering foot. The blood poisoning must not be allowed to advance. She left him quietly sleeping. She went again in the evening. I told her to take the child and bring him to our home. We would treat him under better circumstances. In case of necessity, our house shall be used as a hospital. Sabbath, September 4th. Written after the Sabbath. This morning we did such kind of work as Christ would have done had he been in our world. We harnessed our team, and Sarah went to visit the suffering boy with the cut foot. She took the mother and the boy to Mrs. May White's, my daughter-in-law's, close by our own house. The boy enjoyed the pure air and the ride in the easy phaeton. Then Sarah had the conveniences to dress the afflicted limb. She greatly feared at first that he would lose his limb, but by working with it twice a day for hours with hot compresses, the pain was removed, and the poor little sufferer, who had not slept day or night, fell into slumber, saying, to Sarah's words, "Now try to go to sleep, I can't sleep, I can't sleep, I can't sleep, I can't sleep," until he was fast asleep. Manuscript 176, 1897. 2 days later, Ellen White reported that he was recovering. Early Wednesday morning, Sarah was called to the home of Hiram James, Ellen White's farmer, to attend his wife, who gave birth to a son. It was an easy delivery, and the family now consisted of 2 boys and 4 girls. After effectively treating the badly cut foot for 10 or 12 days, Sarah allowed the boy to return home, with the understanding that she would go see him once a day as long as it was necessary. A pattern was being established, and much of Sarah's time was given to serve as a community nurse. In time, a hospital was built on the grounds of the Avondale School. Were the full story of this phase of ministry fully told, it would fill several chapters. In 1958, when the author spent a few weeks teaching at Avondale College, he was told of the long-lasting influence of such ministry. Many years after the college was built and following World War II, it was necessary to provide some new buildings for the school, but building materials were still in very short supply and of necessity imported. It was anticipated that the best that could be done in securing them would be to get a little here and a little there from different suppliers. At the first firm called on in Newcastle, they found the proprietor to be an elderly gentleman who listened interestedly to their request for help in securing materials for Avondale College. In essence, he replied, "Yes, Avondale College at Corranbong. I grew up as a boy within a few miles of the school, and there was a Mrs. White who lived there. If there was anyone in need, or anyone sick in the community, she was there to give help. Her nurse would travel for miles to treat a sick child, or anyone suffering. I shall never forget what Mrs. White did for us in those days. Gentlemen, I will see that you get all the materials you need. You need go no further, as told to the author. The school representatives returned home with light hearts, and the buildings went up. The unselfish ministry of a little woman and her nurse 50 years earlier had not been forgotten, and unexpectedly yielded gratifying returns. Invitation to John J. Wessels. In the autumn of 1897, Ellen White wrote to John Wessels in South Africa, inviting him to come to Australia to lead out in building and managing a sanitarium that could be provided with his own money. He had suggested to the president of the General Conference that he was going to some place to build a sanitarium, and both Elder Olson and Dr. Kellogg had suggested to Ellen White that she urge Wessels to help out in Australia. She reminded him of the generous contributions that had already been made by members of the Wessels family to Australia, and she told of the needs. Then, in a way quite unique to one who so often wrote of the direct biddings of the Lord, she stated, "I have not been given the message send for Brother John Wessels to come to Australia. No, therefore, I do not say, I know that this is the place for you. But it is my privilege to express my wishes, even though I say, I speak not by commandment. But I do not want you to come because of any persuasion of mine. I want you to seek the Lord most earnestly, and then follow where He shall lead you. I want you to come when God says, come, not one moment before. Nevertheless, it is my privilege to present the wants of the work of God in Australia. Australia is not my country, only as it is the Lord's province. The country is God's. The people are His. A work is to be done here, and if you are not the one to do it, I shall feel perfectly resigned to hear that you have gone to some other locality." Letter 129, 1897. While she had her own personal convictions and desires, Ellen White was careful not to set before people, as a message from God, that which did not have its source in the visions given her. Wessels did not at the time choose to respond to this invitation, but in 1899 he was there, and in later years managed two sanitariums in California. Council on Dress. That winter Ellen White received urgent letters from two leaders in educational institutions in the United States, Joseph Hawtey, principal of South Lancaster Academy, and E. Sutherland, president of Battle Creek College. They were confronted with the work of a Mrs. Porter, a self-styled prophetess who, in her profession to believe the testimonies, was urging that Seventh-day Adventist women return to the Reformed dress of the 1860s. Polly's wife was about convinced this was the course to follow, and he wrote in the hope that God would reveal to them what they should do, Joseph Hawtey to E.G.W., May 2, 1897. As the matter was also urged on Professor Sutherland in Battle Creek, he persuaded those interested to wait until word could come from Ellen White on the matter. He could see that if such were pressed, it could cause quite a disturbance to the church, for, as he wrote Ellen White on May 12, "there are many good sisters here who would put the dress on cheerfully and wear it if the time has come to put it on." While he did not believe in carrying everything to Ellen White that came up, he did feel the need of counsel in this. He urged a reply at her earliest convenience. Ellen White responded, "In answer to the questions that have recently come to me in regard to resuming the Reformed dress, I would say that those who have been agitating this subject may be assured that they have not been inspired by the Spirit of God. The Lord has not indicated that it is the duty of our sisters to go back to the Reformed dress. The dress question is not to be our present truth. I beg of our people to walk carefully and circumspectly before God. Follow the customs in dress so far as they conform to health principles. Let our sisters dress plainly, as many do, having the dress of good, durable material, appropriate for this age, and let not the dress question fill the mind. Our sisters should dress with simplicity. They should clothe themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety. Give to the world a living illustration of the inward adorning of the grace of God." Manuscript 167, 1897. The communication with its balanced message is found in full as the appendix to the book The Story of Our Health Message. Whether by mail or to those who came to her home for counsel, she was ever ready to endeavor to present that which would give safe guidance. On Monday, October 4, after writing on the life of Christ in the early hours of the day and writing some letters, she laid aside her pen for an interview or visit with Elder Haskell about the church edifice that was under construction at Corranbong. As they talked, she picked up her sewing. She wrote, "I had an interview or visit with Elder Haskell. Read to in writings in regard to Haggai Arise, etc. and about allowing debts to remain on the church buildings. While conversing with Elder Haskell, finished the baby's dresses." Manuscript 177, 1897. Ellen White was a homemaker at heart.